For unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away, even that which he hath. Matthew 25:29.
Hachette Audio presents Outliers, the Story of Success. Written and read by Malcolm Gladwell. Featuring a special conversation with the author on CD7.
Outlier, noun. 1. Something that is situated away from or classed differently from a main or related body. 2. A statistical observation that is markedly different in value from the others of the sample. Introduction. The Rosetto Mystery. These people were dying of old age. That's it. Rosetto Valfattore lies 100 miles southeast of Rome, in the Apennine foothills of the Italian province of Foggia. In the style of medieval villages, the town is organized around a large central square. Facing the square is the Palazzo Marchesale, the palace of the Seghese family, once the great landowner of these parts. An archway to one side leads to a church, the Madonna del Carmine. Narrow stone steps run up the hillside, flanked by closely clustered two-story stone houses with red tile roofs. For centuries, the paesani of Rosetto worked in the marble quarries in the surrounding hills, or cultivated the fields in the terraced valley below, walking 4 and 5 miles down the mountain in the morning, and then making the long journey back up the hill at night. It was a hard life. The townsfolk were barely literate and desperately poor and without much hope for economic betterment, until word reached Rosetto at the end of the 19th century of the land of opportunity across the ocean. In January of 1882, a group of 11 Rosettans, 10 men and 1 boy, set sail for New York. They spent their first night in America sleeping on the floor of a tavern on Mulberry Street in Manhattan's Little Italy. Then they ventured west, eventually finding jobs in a slate quarry 90 miles west of the city near the town of Bangor, Pennsylvania. The following year, 15 Rosettans left Italy for America, and several members of that group ended up in Bangor as well, joining their compatriots in the slate quarry. Those immigrants, in turn, sent word back to Rosetto about the promise of the New World, and soon one group of Rosettans after another packed their bags and headed for Pennsylvania, until the initial stream of immigrants became a flood. In 1894 alone, some 1,200 Rosettans applied for passports to America, leaving entire streets of their old village abandoned. The Rosettans began buying land on a rocky hillside, connected to Bangor by a steep, rutted wagon path. They built closely clustered two-story stone houses with slate roofs on narrow streets running up and down the hillside. They built a church and called it Our Lady of Mount Carmel, and named the main street on which it stood Garibaldi Avenue, after the great hero of Italian unification. In the beginning, they called their town New Italy, but they soon changed it to Rosetto, which seemed only appropriate given that in the previous decade, almost all of them had come from the same village in Italy. In 1896, a dynamic young priest by the name of Father Pasquale Denisco took over at Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Denisco set up spiritual societies and organized festivals. He encouraged the town folk to clear the land and plant onions, beans, potatoes, melons, and fruit trees in the long backyards behind their houses. He gave out seeds and bulbs. The town came to life. The Rosettans began raising pigs in their backyards and growing grapes for homemade wine. Schools, a park, a convent, and a cemetery were built. Small shops and bakeries and restaurants and bars opened along Garibaldi Avenue. More than a dozen factories sprang up, making blouses for the garment trade. Neighboring Bangor was largely Welsh and English, and the next town over was overwhelmingly German, which meant, given the fractious relationships between the English and Germans and Italians in those years, that Rosetto stayed strictly for Rosettans. If you had wandered up and down the streets of Rosetto in Pennsylvania in the first few decades after 1900, you would have heard only Italian spoken. And not just any Italian, but the precise southern Foggian dialect spoken back in the Italian Rosetto. Rosetto, Pennsylvania was its own tiny self-sufficient world, all but unknown by the society around it, and may well have remained so, but for a man named Stuart Wolfe. Wolfe was a physician. He studied digestion in the stomach and taught in a medical school at the University of Oklahoma. He spent his summers on a farm in Pennsylvania, not far from Rosetto, although that, of course, didn't mean much, since Rosetto was so much in its own world, it was possible to live one town over and never know much about it. One of the times when we were up there for the summer, this would have been in the late 1950s, I was invited to give a talk at the local medical society, Wolfe said years later in an interview. After the talk was over, one of the local doctors invited me to have a beer. And while we were having a drink, he said, "You know, I've been practicing for 17 years. I get patients from all over, and I rarely find anyone from Rosetto under the age of 65 with heart disease." Wolfe was taken aback. This was the 1950s, years before the advent of cholesterol-lowering drugs and aggressive prevention of heart disease. Heart attacks were an epidemic in the United States. They were the leading cause of death in men under the age of 65. It was impossible to be a doctor, common sense said, and not see heart disease. Wolfe decided to investigate. He enlisted the support of some of his students and colleagues from Oklahoma. They gathered together the death certificates from residents of the town, going back as many years as they could. They analyzed physicians' records. They took medical histories and constructed family genealogies. "We got busy," Wolfe said. "We decided to do a preliminary study. We started in 1961. The mayor said, 'All my sisters are going to help you.' He had four sisters. He said, 'You can have the town council room.' I said, 'Where are you going to have council meetings?' He said, 'Well, we'll postpone them for a while. The ladies would bring us lunch. We had little booths where we would take blood, do EKGs. We were there for 4 weeks. Then I talked with the authorities. They gave us the school for the summer. We invited the entire population of Rosetto to be tested." The results were astonishing. In Rosetto, virtually no one under 55 had died of a heart attack or showed any signs of heart disease. For men over 65, the death rate from heart disease in Rosetto was roughly half that of the United States as a whole. The death rate from all causes in Rosetto, in fact, was 30 or 35% lower than it should have been. Wolfe brought in a friend of his, a sociologist from Oklahoma named John Brune, to help him. "I hired medical students and sociology grad students as interviewers, and in Rosetto we went house to house and talked to every person aged 21 and over," Brune remembers. This happened more than 50 years ago, but Brune still had a sense of amazement in his voice as he described what they found. There was no suicide, no alcoholism, no drug addiction, and very little crime. They didn't have anyone on welfare. Then we looked at peptic ulcers. They didn't have any of those either. These people were dying of old age. That's it." Wolfe's profession had a name for a place like Rosetto, a place that lay outside everyday experience, where the normal rules did not apply. Rosetto was an outlier. Wolfe's first thought was that the Rosettans must have held on to some dietary practices from the old world that left them healthier than other Americans. But he quickly realized that wasn't true. The Rosettans were cooking with lard instead of the much healthier olive oil they'd used back in Italy. Pizza in Italy was a thin crust with salt, oil, and perhaps some tomatoes, anchovies, or onions. Pizza in Pennsylvania was bread dough plus sausage, pepperoni, salami, ham, and sometimes eggs. Sweets like biscotti and tiralli used to be reserved for Christmas and Easter in Rosetto. Now they were eaten all year round. When Wolfe had dietitians analyze the typical Rosettans' eating habits, he found that a whopping 41% of their calories came from fat. Nor was this a town where people got up at dawn to do yoga and run a brisk 6 miles. The Pennsylvanian Rosettans smoked heavily, and many were struggling with obesity. If it wasn't diet and exercise, then, what about genetics? The Rosettans were a close-knit group from the same region of Italy, and Wolfe's next thought was whether they were of a particularly hardy stock that protected them from disease. So he tracked down relatives of the Rosettans who were living in other parts of the United States to see if they shared the same remarkable good health as their cousins in Pennsylvania. They didn't. He then looked at the region where the Rosettans lived. Was it possible that there was something about living in the foothills of eastern Pennsylvania that was good for their health? The two closest towns to Rosetto were Bangor, which was just down the hill, and Nazareth, a few miles away. These were both about the same size as Rosetto and populated with the same kind of hard-working European immigrants. Wolfe combed through both towns' medical records. For men over 65, the death rates from heart disease in Nazareth and Bangor were something like 3 times that of Rosetto. Another dead end. What Wolfe began to realize was that the secret of Rosetto wasn't diet or exercise or genes or location. It had to be Rosetto itself. As Brune and Wolfe walked around the town, they figured out why. They looked at how the Rosettans visited one another, stopping to chat in Italian on the street or cooking for each other in their backyards. They learned about the extended family clans that underlay the town's social structure. They saw how many homes had 3 generations living under one roof and how much respect grandparents commanded. They went to Mass at Our Lady of Mount Carmel and saw the unifying and calming effect of the church. They counted 22 separate civic organizations in a town of just under 2,000 people. They picked up on the particular egalitarian ethos of community that discouraged the wealthy from flaunting their success and helped the unsuccessful obscure their failures. In transplanting the Paisani culture of southern Italy to the hills of eastern Pennsylvania, the Rosettans had created a powerful protective social structure capable of insulating them from the pressures of the modern world. The Rosettans were healthy because of where they were from, because of the world they had created for themselves in their tiny little town in the hills. I remember going to Rosetto for the first time, and you'd see 3 generational family meals, all the bakeries, the people walking up and down the street, sitting on their porches talking to each other, the blouse mills where the women worked during the day while the men worked in the slate quarries, Brune said. It was magical. When Brune and Wolfe first presented their findings to the medical community, you can imagine the kind of skepticism they faced. They went to conferences where their peers were presenting long rows of data arrayed in complex charts and referring to this kind of gene or that kind of physiological process, and they talked instead about the mysterious and magical benefits of people stopping to talk to one another on the street and having 3 generations living under one roof. Living a long life, the conventional wisdom said at the time, depended to a great extent on who we were, that is, our genes. It depended on the decisions people made, on what they chose to eat and how much they chose to exercise, and how effectively they were treated by the medical system. No one was used to thinking about health in terms of community. Wolfe and Brune had to convince the medical establishment to think about health and heart attacks in an entirely new way. They had to get them to realize that you couldn't understand why someone was healthy if all you did was think about an individual's choices or actions in isolation. You had to look beyond the individual. You had to understand the culture they were a part of and who their friends and families were and what town their families came from. You had to appreciate the idea that the values of the world we inhabit and the people we surround ourselves with has a profound effect on who we are. In Outliers, I want to do for our understanding of success what Stuart Wolfe did for our understanding of health. Part 1. Opportunity. Chapter 1. The Matthew Effect. You don't even have to do any statistical analysis. You just look at it. One warm spring day in May of 2007, the Medicine Hat Tigers and the Vancouver Giants met for the Memorial Cup Hockey Championships in Vancouver, British Columbia. The Tigers and the Giants were the 2 finest teams in the Canadian Hockey League, which in turn is the finest junior hockey league in the world. These were the future stars of the sport. 17, 18, and 19-year-olds who had been skating and shooting pucks since they were barely more than toddlers. The game was broadcast on Canadian national television. Up and down the streets of downtown Vancouver, Memorial Cup banners hung from the lampposts. The arena was sold out. A long red carpet was rolled out on the ice, and the announcer introduced the game's dignitaries. First came the Premier of British Columbia, Gordon Campbell. Then, amid tumultuous applause, out walked Gordie Howe, one of the legends of the game. "Ladies and gentlemen," the announcer boomed, "Mr. Hockey." For the next 60 minutes, the two teams played spirited, aggressive hockey. Vancouver scored first, early in the second period, on a rebound by Mario Bliznak. Late in the second period, it was Medicine Hat's turn, as the team's scoring leader, Darren Helm, fired a quick shot past Vancouver's goalie, Tyson Sexsmith. Vancouver answered in the third quarter, scoring the game's deciding goal, and then, when Medicine Hat pulled its goalie in desperation, Vancouver scored a third time. In the aftermath of the game, the players and their families and sports reporters from across the country crammed into the winning team's locker room. The air was filled with cigar smoke and the smell of champagne and sweat-soaked hockey gear. On the wall was a hand-painted banner, "Embrace the Struggle." In the center of the room, the Giants coach, Don Hay, stood misty-eyed. "I'm just so proud of these guys," he said. "Just look around the locker room. There isn't one guy who didn't buy in wholeheartedly." Canadian hockey is a meritocracy. Thousands of Canadian boys begin to play the sport at the novice level before they are even in kindergarten. From that point on, there are leagues for every age class, and at each of those levels, the players are sifted and sorted and evaluated, with the most talented separated out and groomed for the next level. By the time players reach their mid-teens, the very best of the best have been channeled into an elite league known as Major Junior A, which is the top of the pyramid. And if your Major Junior A team plays for the Memorial Cup, that means you're at the very top of the very top of the pyramid. This is the way most sports pick their future stars. It's the way soccer is organized in Europe and South America, and the way Olympic athletes are chosen. For that matter, it's not all that different from the way the world of classical music picks its future virtuosos, and the way the world of ballet picks its future ballerinas, and the way that our elite educational system picks its future scientists and intellectuals. You can't buy your way into Major Junior A hockey. It doesn't matter who your father or mother is, or who your grandfather was, or what business your family is in. Nor does it matter if you live in the most remote corner of the most northerly province in Canada. If you have ability, the vast network of hockey scouts and talent spotters will find you. And if you are willing to work to develop that ability, the system will reward you. Success in hockey is based on individual merit, and both of those words are important. Players are judged on their own performance, not anyone else's, and on the basis of ability, not some other arbitrary fact. Or are they? This is a book about outliers, about men and women who do things that are out of the ordinary. Over the course of the chapters ahead, I'm going to introduce you to one kind of outlier after another, to geniuses, business tycoons, rock stars, and software programmers. We're going to uncover the secrets of a remarkable lawyer, look at what separates the very best pilots from pilots who have crashed planes, and try to figure out why Asians are so good at math. And in examining the lives of the remarkable among us, the skilled, the talented, and the driven, I will argue that there is something profoundly wrong with the way we make sense of success. What is the question we always ask about the successful? We want to know what they're like, what kind of personalities they have, or how intelligent they are, or what kind of lifestyles they have, or what special talents they might have been born with. And we assume that it is those personal qualities that explain how an individual reaches the top. In the autobiographies published every year by the billionaire, entrepreneur, rock star, celebrity, the storyline is always the same. Our hero is born in modest circumstances and by virtue of his own grit and talent fights his way to greatness. In the Bible, Joseph is cast out by his brothers and sold into slavery, and then rises to become the Pharaoh's right-hand man on the strength of his own brilliance and insight. In the famous 19th-century novels of Horatio Alger, young boys born into poverty rise to riches through a combination of pluck and initiative. "I think overall it's a disadvantage," Jeb Bush once said, of what it meant for his business career that he was the son of an American president and the brother of an American president and the grandson of a wealthy Wall Street banker and a U.S. senator. When he ran for governor of Florida, he repeatedly referred to himself as a self-made man, and it is a measure of how deeply we associate success with the efforts of the individual that few batted an eyelid at that description. "Lift up your heads," Robert Winthrop told the crowd many years ago at the unveiling of a statue of that great hero of American independence, Benjamin Franklin, "and look at the image of a man who rose from nothing, who owed nothing to parentage or patronage, who enjoyed no advantages of early education which are not open, a hundredfold open, to yourselves, who performed the most menial services in the business in which his early life was employed, but who lived to stand before kings and died to leave a name which the world will never forget." In Outliers, I want to convince you that these kinds of personal explanations of success don't work. People don't rise from nothing. We do owe something to parentage and patronage. The people who stand before kings may look like they did it all by themselves, but in fact, they are invariably the beneficiaries of hidden advantages and extraordinary opportunities and cultural legacies that allow them to learn and work hard and make sense of the world in a way others cannot. It makes a difference where and when we grew up. The culture we belong to and the legacies passed down by our forebears shape the patterns of our achievement in ways we cannot begin to imagine. It's not enough to ask what successful people are like, in other words. It is only by asking where they are from that we can unravel the logic behind who succeeds and who doesn't. Biologists often talk about the ecology of an organism. The tallest oak in the forest is not just the tallest because it grew from the hardiest acorn. It is also the tallest because no other trees blocked its sunlight, because the soil around it was deep and rich, because no rabbit chewed through its bark as a sapling, and because no lumberjack cut it down before it matured. We all know that successful people come from hardy seeds. But do we know enough about the sunlight that warmed them, the soil in which they put down their roots, and the rabbits and lumberjacks they were lucky enough to avoid? This is not a book about tall trees. It's a book about forests. And hockey is a good place to start, because the explanation for who gets to the top of the hockey world is a lot more interesting and complicated than it looks. In fact, it's downright peculiar. If you were to look at the player roster of the 2007 Medicine Hat Tigers, you might see something strange about it. But even if you didn't, you shouldn't feel bad, because for many years in the hockey world, no one did. It wasn't until the mid-1980s, in fact, that a Canadian psychologist named Roger Barnsley first drew attention to the phenomenon of relative age. Barnsley was at a Lethbridge Broncos hockey game in southern Alberta, a team that played in the same major junior A league as the Vancouver Giants and the Medicine Hat Tigers. He was there with his wife, Paula, and their two boys, and his wife was reading the program when she ran across the roster list. "Roger," she said, "do you know when these young men were born?" Barnsley said, "Yes. They're all between 16 and 20, so they'd be born in the late 1960s. "No, no," Paula went on. "What month?" "I thought she was crazy," Barnsley remembered. But I looked through it, and what she was saying just jumped out at me. For some reason, there were an incredible number of January, February, and March birthdates. Barnsley went home that night and looked at the birthdates of as many professional hockey players as he could find. He saw the same pattern. Barnsley, his wife, and a colleague, A.H. Thompson, then gathered statistics on every player in the Ontario Junior Hockey League. The story was the same. More players are born in January than in any other month, and by an overwhelming margin. The second most frequent birth month? February. The third? March. Barnsley found that there were nearly 5.5 times as many Ontario Hockey League players born in January as were born at the end of the year in November. He looked at the All-Star teams of 11-year-olds and 13-year-olds, the young players selected for elite traveling squads. Same story. He looked at the composition of the National Hockey League. Same story. The more he looked, the more Barnsley came to believe that what he was seeing was not a chance occurrence, but an iron law of Canadian hockey. That any time you look at an elite group of hockey players, the very best of the best, you can reliably assume that 40% of the players will be born between January and March, 30% between April and June, 20% between July and September, and 10% between October and December. In all my years in psychology, I have never run into an effect this large, Barnsley says. You don't even need to do any statistical analysis. You just look at it. What would you have seen if you'd looked at that Medicine Hat roster? 17 out of the 25 players on the team were born in January, February, March, or April. Here is the play-by-play for the first two goals in the Memorial Cup final, only this time I've substituted the players' birthdays for their names. It no longer sounds like the Championship of Canadian Junior Hockey. It now sounds like a strange sporting ritual for teenage boys born under the astrological signs Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. March 11th starts around one side of the Tigers' net, leaving the puck for his teammate January 4th, who passes it to January 22nd, who flips it back to March 12th, who shoots point-blank at the Tigers' goalie April 27th. April 27th blocks the shot, but it's rebounded by Vancouver's March 6th. He shoots. Medicine Hat defensemen February 9th and February 14th dive to block the puck, while January 10th looks on helplessly. March 6th scores! Let's go to the second period now. Medicine Hat's turn. The Tigers' scoring leader, January 21st, charges down the right side of the ice. He stops and circles, eluding the Vancouver defenseman February 15th. January 21st then deftly passes the puck to his teammate, December 20th. Wow, what's he doing out there? Who shrugs off the onrushing defender May 17th and slides a cross-crease pass back to January 21st. He shoots. Vancouver defenseman March 12th dives, trying to block the shot. Vancouver's goalie March 19th lunges, helplessly. January 21st scores. He raises his hands in triumph. His teammate May 2nd jumps on his back with joy. The explanation for this is quite simple. It has nothing to do with astrology or anything magical about the first 3 months of the year. It's simply that in Canada, the eligibility cutoff for age class hockey is January 1st. A boy who turns 10 on January 2nd then could be playing alongside someone who doesn't turn 10 until the end of the year. And at that age, in pre-adolescence, a 12-month gap in age represents an enormous difference in physical maturity. This being Canada, the most hockey-crazed country on earth, coaches start to select players for the traveling rep squad, the All-Star teams, at the age of 9 or 10. And of course, they are more likely to view as talented the bigger and more coordinated players who have had the benefit of those extra critical months of maturity. And what happens when a player gets chosen for a rep squad? He gets better coaching, and his teammates are better, and he plays 50 or 75 games a season instead of 20 games a season like those left behind in the house league, and he practices twice or even three times more than he would have otherwise. In the beginning, his advantage wasn't so much that he was inherently better, but only that he was a little older. But by the age of 13 or 14, with the benefit of better coaching and all that extra practice under his belt, he really is better. So he's the one more likely to make it to Major Junior A, and from there into the big leagues. Barnsley argues that these kind of skewed age distributions exist wherever three things happen: selection, streaming, and differentiated experience. If you make a decision about who is good and who is not at an early age, if you separate the so-called talented from the so-called untalented, and if you provide the so-called talented with a superior experience, then you're going to end up giving a huge advantage to that small group of people born closest to the cutoff date. In the United States, football and basketball don't have these problems. They don't select and stream and differentiate quite as dramatically. As a result, a child can be a bit behind physically in those sports and still play as much as his or her more mature peers. But baseball does. The cutoff date for almost all non-school baseball leagues in the United States is July 31st, with the result that more major league players are born in August than any other month. The numbers are striking. In 2005, there were 505 Americans born in August playing Major League Baseball versus 313 born in July. European soccer, similarly, is organized like hockey and baseball, and the birthday distributions in that sport are heavily skewed as well. In England, the eligibility date is September 1st. And in the Football Association's Premier League at one point in the 1990s, there were 288 players born between September and November, and only 136 players born between June and August. In international soccer, the cutoff date used to be August 1st, and in one recent Junior World Championship tournament, there were 135 players born in the first 3 months after August 1st, and just 22 born in May, June, and July. Today, the cutoff date for international junior soccer is January 1st. And if you look at the roster of the 2007 Czechoslovakian national junior soccer team, which made the Junior World Cup finals, do you know what you find? Of the team's 21 players, 6 were born in January, 6 were born in February, 3 were born in March, 1 was born in April, and no one on the team was born after the end of September. At the national team tryouts, the Czech soccer coaches might as well have told everyone born after midsummer to pack their bags and go home. Hockey and soccer are just games, of course, involving a select few. But these exact same biases also show up in areas of much more consequence, like education. Parents with a child born at the end of the calendar year often think about holding their child back before the start of kindergarten. It's hard for a 5-year-old to keep up with a child born many months earlier. But most parents, one suspects, think that whatever disadvantage a younger child faces in kindergarten eventually goes away. But it doesn't. It's just like hockey. The small initial advantage that the child born in the early part of the year has over the child born at the end of the year persists. It locks children into patterns of achievement and underachievement, encouragement and discouragement that stretch on for years and years. Recently, two economists, Kelly Bedard and Elizabeth Dewey, decided to look at the relationship between scores on what's called TIMSS, the math and science test given every 4 years to children around the world, and month of birth. They found that among fourth graders, the oldest children score somewhere between 4 and 12 percentile points better than the youngest children. That, as Dewey explains, is a huge effect. It means that if you take two intellectually equivalent fourth graders with birthdays at opposite ends of the cutoff date, the older student could score in the 80th percentile, while the younger one could score in the 68th percentile. That's the difference between qualifying for a gifted program and not. It's just like sports, Dewey said. We do ability grouping early on in childhood. We have advanced reading groups and advanced math groups. So early on, if we look at young kids in kindergarten and first grade, the teachers are confusing maturity with ability. And they put the older kids in the advanced stream where they learn better skills. And the next year, because they're in the higher groups, they do even better. And the next year, the same thing happens, and they do even better again. The only country we don't see this going on is in Denmark. They have a national policy where they have no ability grouping until the age of 10. In other words, Denmark waits to make selection decisions until maturity differences by age have evened out. Dewey and Bedard subsequently did the same analysis, only this time looking at college. What did they find? At 4-year colleges in the United States, the highest stream of post-secondary education, students belonging to the relatively youngest group in their class are underrepresented by about 11.6%. That initial difference in maturity doesn't go away with time. It persists. And for thousands of students, that initial disadvantage is the difference between going to college and having a real shot at the middle class and not. I mean, it's ridiculous, Dewey says. Think for a moment about what the story of hockey and early birthdays tells us about success. It tells us that our notion that it is the best and the brightest who effortlessly rise to the top is much too simplistic. Yes, the hockey players who make it to the professional level are more talented than you or me. But they also got a big head start, an opportunity that they neither deserved nor earned. And that opportunity played a critical role in their success. The sociologist Robert Merton famously called this kind of phenomenon the Matthew effect, after the New Testament verse in the Gospel of Matthew, "For unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath." It is those who are successful who are most likely to be given the kinds of special opportunities that lead to further success. It's the rich who get the biggest tax breaks. It's the best students who get the best teaching and the most attention. And it's the biggest 9- and 10-year-olds who get the most coaching and practice. Success is the result of what sociologists like to call a cumulative advantage. The professional hockey player starts out a little bit better than his peers, and that little difference leads to an opportunity that makes that difference a bit bigger, and that edge in turn leads to another opportunity that makes the initially small difference bigger still, and on until the hockey player is a genuine outlier. But he didn't start out an outlier. He started out just a little bit better. The second implication of the hockey example is that the systems we set up to determine who gets ahead aren't particularly efficient. We think that starting all-star leagues and gifted programs as early as possible is the best way of ensuring that no talent slips through the cracks. But take a look again at that roster for the Czech Republic junior soccer team. There are no players born in July, October, November, or December, and only one each from August and September. Those born in the last half of the year have all been discouraged or overlooked or pushed out of the sport. The talent of essentially half of the Czech athletic population has been squandered. So what do you do if you're an athletic young Czech with the misfortune to have been born in the last part of the year? You can't play soccer. The deck is stacked against you. So maybe you could play the other sport the Czechs are obsessed with, hockey. But wait, I think you know what's coming. The 2007 Czech junior hockey team that finished fifth at the World Championships had 3 players born in January, 5 born in February, 3 born in March, and only 2 born after August 31st. Those born in the last quarter of the year might as well give up on hockey as well. Do you see the consequences of the way we have chosen to think about success? Because we so profoundly personalize success, we miss opportunities to lift others onto the top rung. We make rules that frustrate achievement. We prematurely write off people as failures. We are much too in awe of those who succeed and far too dismissive of those who fail. And most of all, we become much too passive. We overlook just how large a role we all play, and by we I mean society, in determining who makes it and who doesn't. If we chose to, we could acknowledge that cutoff dates matter. We could set up 2 or even 3 hockey leagues, divided up by month of birth. Let the players develop on separate tracks, and then pick all-star teams. If all the Czech and Canadian athletes born at the end of the year had a fair chance, then the Czech and the Canadian national teams would suddenly have twice as many athletes to choose from. Schools could do the same thing. Elementary and middle schools could put their January, February, March, and April students in one class, and the summer-borns in another class, and the fall and winter-borns in a third class. They could let students learn with and compete against other students of the same maturity level. It would be a little bit more complicated administratively, but it wouldn't necessarily cost that much more money, and it would level the playing field for those who, for no fault of their own, have been dealt a big disadvantage by the educational system. We could easily take control of the machinery of achievement, in other words, and not just in sports, but, as we will see, in other more consequential areas as well. But we don't. And why? because we cling to the idea that success is a simple function of individual merit, and that the world in which we all grow up and the rules we choose to write as a society don't matter at all. Before the Memorial Cup final, Gord Wasden, the father of one of the Medicine Hat Tigers, stood by the side of the ice talking about his son Scott. He was wearing a Medicine Hat baseball cap and a black Medicine Hat t-shirt. When he was 4 and 5 years old, Wasden remembered, his little brother was in a walker, and he would shove a hockey stick in his hand, and they would play hockey on the floor in the kitchen, morning till night. Scott always had a passion for it. He played rep hockey throughout his minor league hockey career. He always made the AAA teams. As a first-year peewee or a first-year bantam, he always played on the top rep team. Wasden was clearly nervous. His son was about to play in the biggest game of his life. He's had to work very hard for whatever he's got. I'm very proud of him. These were the ingredients of success at the highest level: passion, talent, and hard work. But there was another element. When did Wasden first get the sense that his son was something special? You know, he was always a bigger kid for his age. He was strong and he had a knack for scoring goals at an early age. And he was always kind of a standout for his age, a captain of his team. Big for his age? Of course he was. Scott Wasden was born on January 4th, within 3 days of the absolute perfect birthday for an elite hockey player. He was one of the lucky ones. And if by some whim, the eligibility date for Canadian hockey was later in the year, he might have been watching the Memorial Cup championship from the stands instead of playing on the ice. Chapter 2, The 10,000-Hour Rule. In Hamburg, we had to play for 8 hours. The University of Michigan opened its new computer center in 1971 in a brand new building on Beale Avenue in Ann Arbor, with beige brick exterior walls and a dark glass front. The university's enormous mainframe computers stood in the middle of a vast white room, looking, as one faculty member remembers, like one of the last scenes in the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey. Off to the side were dozens of key punch machines, what passed in those days for computer terminals. In 1971, this was state of the art. The University of Michigan had one of the most advanced computer science programs in the world, and over the course of the computer center's life, thousands of students passed through that white room, the most famous of whom was a gawky teenager named Bill Joy. Joy came to the University of Michigan the year the computer center opened. He was 16. He was tall and very thin, with a mop of unruly hair. He had been voted most studious student by his graduating class at North Farmington High School outside of Detroit, which, as he puts it, meant that he was a no-date nerd. He had thought he might end up as a biologist or a mathematician, but late in his freshman year, he stumbled across the computing center, and he was hooked. From that point on, the computer center was his life. He programmed whenever he could. Joy got a job with a computer science professor so he could program over the summer. In 1975, Joy enrolled in graduate school at the University of California at Berkeley. There, he buried himself even deeper into the world of computer software. During the oral exams for his PhD, he made up a particularly complicated algorithm on the fly that, as one of his many admirers has written, so stunned his examiners that one of them later compared the experience to Jesus confounding his elders. Working in collaboration with a small group of programmers, Joy took on the task of rewriting Unix, which was a software system developed by AT&T for mainframe computers. Joy's version was very good. It was so good, in fact, that it became, and remains, the operating system on which literally millions of computers around the world run. "If you put your Mac in that funny mode where you can see the code," Joy says, "I see things that I remember typing in 25 years ago. And when you go online, do you know who wrote much of the software that allows you to access the Internet? Bill Joy." After graduating from Berkeley, Joy co-founded the Silicon Valley firm Sun Microsystems, which was one of the most critical players in the computer revolution. Then he rewrote another computer language, Java, and his legend grew still further. Among Silicon Valley insiders, Joy is spoken of with as much awe as someone like Bill Gates of Microsoft. He is sometimes called the Edison of the Internet. As the Yale computer scientist David Gelertner says, Bill Joy is one of the most influential people in the modern history of computing. The story of Bill Joy's genius has been told many times, and the lesson is always the same. Here was a world that was the purest of meritocracies. Computer programming didn't operate as an old boy network where you got ahead because of money or connections. It was a wide open field in which all participants were judged solely by their talent and their accomplishments. It was a world where the best men won, and Joy was clearly one of those best men. It would be easier to accept that version of events, however, if we hadn't just looked at hockey and soccer players. Theirs was supposed to be a pure meritocracy as well, only it wasn't. It was a story of how the outliers in a particular field reached their lofty status through a combination of ability, opportunity, and utterly arbitrary advantage. Is it possible the same pattern of special opportunities operate in the real world as well? Let's go back over the story of Bill Joy and find out. For almost a generation, psychologists around the world have been engaged in a spirited debate over a question that most of us would have considered settled years ago. The question is this: is there such a thing as innate talent? The obvious answer is yes. Not every hockey player born in January ends up playing at the professional level. Only some do, the innately talented ones. Achievement is talent plus preparation. The problem with this view, though, is that the closer psychologists look at the careers of the gifted, the smaller the role innate talent seems to play, and the bigger the role preparation seems to play. Exhibit A in this argument is a study done in the early 1990s by the psychologist K. Anders Ericsson and two colleagues at Berlin's Elite Academy of Music. With the help of the Academy's professors, they divided the school's violinists into three groups. In the first group were the stars, the students with the potential to become world-class soloists. In the second were those judged to be merely good. In the third were students who were unlikely to ever play professionally and who intended to be music teachers in the public school system. All of the violinists would then ask the same question. Over the course of your entire career, ever since you first picked up the violin, how many hours have you practiced? Everyone from all three groups started playing at roughly the same time, around the age of 5. In those first few years, everyone practiced roughly the same amount, about 2 or 3 hours a week. But around the age of 8, real differences started to emerge. The students who would end up as the best in their class began to practice more than everyone else, 6 hours a week by age 9, 8 hours a week by age 12, 16 hours a week by age 14, and up until by the age of 20, they were practicing, that is, purposefully and single-mindedly playing their instruments with the intent to get better, well over 30 hours a week. In fact, by the age of 20, the elite performers had totaled 10,000 hours of practice over the course of their lives. By contrast, the merely good students had totaled 8,000 hours, and the future music teachers had totaled just over 4,000 hours. Ericsson and his colleagues then compared amateur pianists with professional pianists. The same pattern emerged. The amateurs never practiced more than about 3 hours a week over the course of their childhood, and by the age of 20 had totaled 2,000 hours of practice. The professionals, on the other hand, steadily increased their practice time every year until by the age of 20 they had reached 10,000 hours. The thing about Ericsson's study is that he and his colleagues couldn't find any naturals, musicians who floated effortlessly to the top while practicing a fraction of the time their peers did. Nor could they find any grinds, people who worked harder than everyone else, yet just didn't have what it takes to break into the top ranks. Their research suggested that once you have enough ability to get into a top music school, the thing that distinguishes one performer from another is how hard he or she works, That's it. And what's more, the people at the very top don't just work much harder than everyone else. They work much, much harder. This idea that excellence at a complex task requires a critical minimum level of practice surfaces again and again in studies of expertise. In fact, researchers have settled on what they believe is the magic number for true expertise, 10,000 hours. The emerging picture from such studies is that 10,000 hours of practice is required to achieve the level of mastery associated with being a world-class expert in anything. Writes the neurologist Daniel Levitin, in study after study of composers, basketball players, fiction writers, ice skaters, concert pianists, chess players, master criminals, and what have you, this number comes up again and again. 10,000 hours is equivalent to roughly 3 hours a day or 20 hours a week of practice over 10 years. Of course, this doesn't address why some people get more out of their practice sessions than others, but no one has yet found a case in which true world-class expertise was accomplished in less time. It seems that it takes the brain this long to assimilate all that it needs to know to achieve true mastery. This is true even of people we think of as prodigies. Mozart, for example, famously started writing music at 6. But, according to the psychologist Michael Howe in his book Genius Explained, by the standards of mature composers, Mozart's early works are not outstanding. The earliest pieces were probably written down by his father and perhaps improved in the process. Many of Wolfgang's childhood compositions, such as the first 7 of his concertos for piano and orchestra, are largely arrangements of works by other composers. Of those concertos that only contain music original to Mozart, the earliest that is now regarded as a masterwork, number 9, K-271, was not composed until he was 21. By that time, Mozart had already been composing concertos for 10 years. The music critic Harald Schoenberg goes further. Mozart, he argues, actually developed late, since he didn't produce his greatest work until he had been composing for over 20 years. To become a chess grandmaster also seems to take about 10 years. Only the legendary Bobby Fischer got to that elite level in less than that time. It took him 9 years. And what's 10 years? Well, it's roughly how long it takes to put in 10,000 hours of hard practice. 10,000 hours is the magic number of greatness. Here is the explanation for what was so puzzling about the rosters of the Czech and Canadian national sports teams. There was virtually no one on those teams born after September 1st, which doesn't seem to make any sense. You'd think that there should be a fair number of Czech hockey or soccer prodigies born late in the year who are so talented that they eventually make their way into the top tier as young adults. But to Erickson and those who argue against the primacy of talent, that isn't surprising at all. That late-born prodigy doesn't get chosen for the All-Star team as an 8-year-old because he's too small, so he doesn't get the extra practice. And without that extra practice, he has no chance at hitting 10,000 hours by the time the professional hockey teams start looking for players. And without 10,000 hours under his belt, there is no way he can ever master the skills necessary to play at the top level. Even Mozart, the greatest musical prodigy of all time, couldn't hit his stride until he had his 10,000 hours in. Practice isn't the thing you do once you're good. It's the thing you do that makes you good. The other interesting thing about that 10,000 hours number, of course, is that 10,000 hours is an enormous amount of time. It's all but impossible to reach that number by the time you're a young adult all by yourself. You have to have parents who encourage and support you. You can't be poor because if you have to hold down a part-time job on the side to help make ends meet, there won't be enough time left over in the day to practice. In fact, most people can only really reach that number if they get into some kind of special program, like a hockey all-star squad, or they get some kind of extraordinary opportunity that gives them a chance to put in those hours. So, back to Bill Joy. It's 1971. He's tall and gawky and 16 years old. He's the math whiz, the kind of student at schools like MIT or Caltech or the University of Waterloo attract by the hundreds. When Bill was a little boy, he wanted to know everything about everything way before he should have even known what he wanted to know, his father William says. We answered him when we could, and when we couldn't, we would just give him a book. When it came time to apply to college, Joy got a perfect score on the math portion of the Scholastic Aptitude Test. It wasn't particularly hard, he says, matter-of-factly. There was plenty of time to check it twice. He has talent by the truckload. But that's not the only consideration. It never is. The key to his development is that he stumbled across that nondescript building on Beale Avenue. In the early 1970s, when Joy was learning about programming, computers were the size of rooms. A single machine, which might have less power and memory than your microwave now has, could cost upwards of $1 million. And that's in 1970s dollars. Computers were rare. If you found them, they were hard to get access to. And if you managed to get access, renting time on them cost a fortune. What's more, programming itself was extraordinarily tedious. This was the era when computer programs were created using cardboard punch cards. Each line of code was imprinted on the card using a key punch machine. A complex program might include hundreds, if not thousands, of these cards in tall stacks. Once a program was ready, you walked over to whatever mainframe computer you had access to and gave the stack of cards to an operator. Since computers could only handle one task at a time, the operator made an appointment for your program, and depending how many people were ahead of you in line, you might not get your cards back for a few hours or even a day. And if you made even a single error, even a typographical error, in your program, you had to take the cards back, track down the error, and begin the whole process again. Under those circumstances, it was exceedingly difficult for anyone to become a programming expert. Certainly becoming an expert by your early 20s was all but impossible. When you can only program for a few minutes out of every hour you spend in the computer room, how can you ever get to 10,000 hours of practice? Programming with cards, one computer scientist from that era remembers, did not teach you programming. It taught you patience and proofreading. It wasn't until the mid-1960s that a solution to the programming problem emerged. Computers were finally powerful enough that they could handle more than one appointment at once. If you rewrote the computer's operating system, computer scientists realized, the machine's time could be shared. It could be trained to handle hundreds of tasks at the same time. That, in turn, meant that programmers didn't have to physically hand their stack of computer cards to the operator anymore. You could build dozens of terminals, link them all to the mainframe by a telephone line, and have everyone working online all at once. Here is how one history of the period describes the advent of time-sharing. This was not just a revolution. It was a revelation. Forget the operator, the card decks, the wait. With time-sharing, you could sit at your teletype, bang in a couple of commands, and get an answer then and there. Time-sharing was interactive. A program could ask for a response, wait for you to type it in, act on it while you waited, and show you the result all in real time. This is where Michigan came in, because Michigan was one of the first universities in the world to switch over to time-sharing. By 1967, a prototype of the system was up and running. By the early 1970s, Michigan had enough computing power that 100 people could be programming simultaneously in the computer center. In the late 60s, early 70s, I don't think there was anywhere else that was exactly like Michigan. Mike Alexander, who was one of the pioneers at Michigan in setting up the university's computer system, said, "Maybe MIT, maybe Carnegie Mellon, maybe Dartmouth. I don't think there were any others." This was the opportunity that greeted Bill Joy when he arrived on the Ann Arbor campus in the fall of 1971. He hadn't chosen Michigan because of its computers. He had never done anything with computers in high school. He was interested in math and engineering and biology. But when the programming bug hit him in his freshman year, he found himself, by the happiest of accidents, in one of the few places in the world where a 17-year-old could program all he wanted. "Do you know what the difference is between the computing cards and time-sharing?" Joy says. "It's the difference between playing chess by mail and speed chess." Programming wasn't an exercise in frustration anymore. It was fun. "I lived in the North Campus, and the computer center was in the North Campus," Joy went on. "How much time did I spend there? Oh, a phenomenal amount of time. It was open 24 hours. I would stay there all night and just walk home in the morning. In an average week in those years, I was spending more time in the computer center than in my classes. All of us down there had this recurring nightmare of forgetting to show up for class at all, of not even realizing we were enrolled. The challenge was that they gave all the students an account with a fixed amount of money, so your time would run out. When you signed on, you would put in how long you wanted to spend on the computer. They gave you like an hour of time. That's all you'd get, he said, laughing at the memory. But someone figured out that if you put in time equals and then a letter, like T equals K, they wouldn't charge you. It was a bug in the software. You could put in T equals K and sit there forever. Just look at the stream of opportunities that came Bill Joy's way. Because he happened to go to a far-sighted school like the University of Michigan, he was able to practice on a time-sharing system instead of punch cards. Because the Michigan system happened to have a bug in it, he could program all he wanted. Because the university was willing to spend the money to keep the computer center open 24 hours, he could stay up all night. And because he was able to put in so many hours, by the time he happened to be presented with the opportunity to rewrite Unix, he was up to the task. Bill Joy was brilliant. He wanted to learn. That was a big part of it. But before he could become an expert, someone had to give him the opportunity to learn how to be an expert. At Michigan, I was probably programming 8 or 10 hours a day, he went on. By the time I was at Berkeley, I was doing it day and night. I had a terminal at home. I'd stay up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning watching old movies and programming. Sometimes I'd fall asleep at the keyboard. He mimed his head falling onto the keyboard. And you know how the key repeats until the end and it starts to go beep, beep, beep? After that happens 3 times, you have to go to bed. I was still relatively incompetent even when I got to Berkeley. I was proficient by my 2nd year there. That's when I wrote programs that are still in use today, 30 years later. He paused for a moment to do the math in his head, which, for someone like Bill Joy, doesn't take very long. Michigan in 1971. Programming in earnest by sophomore year. Add in the summers and the days and nights in his 1st year at Berkeley. It's 5 years, he said, finally. I didn't start the day I started at Michigan, so maybe 10,000 hours? That's about right.